All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, March 12, 2013 Carborough Board of Aldermen meeting. Before we begin our regularly printed agenda, I would just like to recognize Alderman Randy Haven O'Donnell.
I'd like to be back, guys. Thank you for your card and your flowers and the centers and to those in the community. Thank you. I wanted to share that Megan Truesdale and Duncan Morgan had been awarded the TS design, award-winning design for the North Carolina Shirt to Dirt contest, design contest, and that's a design, Carolina or Bust. And they're right here in Carborough on High Street. So I wanted folks to know that their design will represent the program of Carolina Cotton.
So awesome.
Thank you.
That's a great shirt. Very Carborough looking, isn't it?
That is so cool.
Very nice.
Mark, we have a couple of proclamations, too.
Oh, we have a couple of
resolutions.
Okay. All right. Hope we do. Hello. Okay. That brings us to a resolution in response to House Bill 1D for anti-immigration legislation.
Jackie. Michelle and I, along with the rest of the board, were very saddened and worried with the governor signing off on House Bill 184, which is intended to clarify the beneficiaries of the Federal Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals initiative are eligible to obtain driver's license in this state. These are what we sometimes call the DREAM Act kids, and the new legislation will really hurt them. Whereas the requirements of this act will create licenses that have background colors and borders, distinguishing a mark or other designation on the face of the license, clearly denoting the limited duration of the license. Whereas young immigrants who were brought to the United States illegally but by their parents, but have been granted legal presence for 2 years by the federal government, may seek driving privileges through the State Division of Motor Vehicles. Whereas the licenses will have a bold pink stripe across the top and the phrase, no lawful status. Think about that. That is horrible. In capital red letters down the side. What that says to that young person and to everybody who sees the license. Whereas North Carolina is the only state in the country that has ever issued this type of license, deferred action has been given to other immigrants in the past. This is the first time that a state has created a license specifying a person's immigration status. Whereas this act of creating licenses with a pink stripe and the words no lawful status is both discriminatory and oppressive to Latinos and people of color. Whereas there are many other programs in need of support and resources, and the current state administration is making use of taxpayer money to create a new license class with a discriminatory message regarding a group of individuals who have grown up in and contributed to the growth of the state of North Carolina. Whereas the new license puts obstacles in front of many young immigrants, creating a class of inferior citizens. Now, therefore, the Carborough Board of Aldermen requests that the governor and legislatures of North Carolina reconsider their actions and the profoundly negative effect the pink, no lawful status licenses will have on the lives of innocent people and rescind House Bill 184. Until this law is rescinded, the Carborough Board of Aldermen urges all citizens of North Carolina to attach a strip of pink tape to their licenses. This is a movement that's been started in many of our churches and communities. So I would like to enter that resolution.
Second. All right. Thank you, Jackie.
And Michelle.
Thanks, y'all, for bringing that.
Really important.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passes unanimously. Thanks very much.
You need pink tape.
The governor says it's fuchsia, but anyway, And then we also have another resolution opposing Senate Bill 76, the so-called Domestic Energy Jobs Act.
Yeah, so this is part of unfortunately, I think our meetings will begin with a lot of resolutions in response to the insanity that's happening.
Very effective resolutions.
But hopefully this will be a trend throughout many municipalities of North Carolina, and we can join forces and put up some kind of resistance, is my hope.
And muddle the way.
Yeah. So this one is in response to Senate Bill 76, which is called the Domestic Energy Jobs Act. But it's essentially, should I read it, or do y'all want me to summarize it?
Why don't you hit a few key whereas clauses?
Sure. Whereas the Clean Energy and Economic Security Act established a procedure by which the Mining and Energy Commission would develop a modern oil and gas regulatory program and placed a moratorium on the issuance of permits in order to give the General Assembly the opportunity to review the Mining and Energy Commission's regulations. Whereas the recently introduced Senate Bill 76, SB 76, represents the efforts of some members of the North Carolina General Assembly to renege on promises made last year. Specifically, SB 76 would lift the moratorium established in session law 2012-143 on March 1st, 2015. SB 76 would allow the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources to begin issuing permits without any additional legislative review of these new rules. Whereas SB 76 would legalize the underground injection of hydraulic fracturing fluid for the exploration or development of natural gas resources and water produced from subsurface geologic formations during the extraction of natural gas, condensate, or oil, opening North Carolina to wastewater not only from our own drilling operations but from other states as well. Whereas a landman registry is essential to the protection of property owners, and eliminating this requirement would prevent public access to information about entities operating in North Carolina and would relieve operators from the obligation to provide DENR with information about their record in other states. Whereas SB 76 would prohibit local governments from taxing any aspect of oil and gas or gas development activity, hindering the ability of local governments to adequately address negative impacts from oil and gas exploration and development activities. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the Town of Carver urges the North Carolina General Assembly to keep its promises to the citizens of North Carolina upon the passage of Session Law 2012-143 by rejecting Senate Bill 76. Be it further resolved, the Town of Carver calls upon all other municipal and county governing bodies of North Carolina and OWASA to pass similar resolutions to this one, and that the legal municipalities and tribal J Council of Governments join us in this effort. So it's basically another bad law, making even worse the previous bad law, establishing or setting course in the process for allowing fracking in North Carolina. And it's a breaking of a promise that many of the legislators who initiated that process initially had said that first bill had as safeguards to guarantee that things wouldn't be rushed. So. This is bad.
All right. So. Thank you, Sammy, for bringing that forward.
If that's a move, I'll second it.
I reckon it is, and I reckon you do. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
And I'd like to thank Michelle for being part of spearheading this resolution. Thanks, Michelle.
All right. I believe that brings us to our consent agenda, appointment to Recreation and Parks Commission. We have a resolution appointing Annetta Streeter to from the Chapel Hill Carborough City School Board to the Recreation and Parks Commission.
Move the item.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Mr. Mayor, we also have a charge tonight for the Arts Committee, I believe. I'm not sure if they're here or not.
Okay.
Jay Parker.
Jay's
not here.
Jay is not here.
All right.
There's no way we could have missed it if Jay was here.
But he came to the meeting last night.
Good deal.
Mr. Attorney.
I also would like to ask the board to add a closed session item at the end of the meeting to discuss the possible purchase of property by the town at 203 South Greensboro Street.
Okay. Is there a motion to amend the agenda thus?
So moved. Second.
Moved and seconded. We'll consider that item E1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. All right, that brings us to item B1, a follow-up discussion on affordable housing task force recommendations. Mr. Manager.
Mr. Mayor, members of the Board of Aldermen, Trish, how are we going to proceed? Okay. Yep, and then we'll turn it over to them.
In order not to take time away from your discussion, this will be a brief presentation just to kind of frame where we are and why we're talking about this again tonight. Suffice it to say, there's been more than 30 years of history for the town looking at ways of having a diverse housing stock. But, you know, times change. The market has changed both for builders and for buyers. And I think this became apparent last year when the Home Trust came before you on more than one occasion just in 1 year looking for text amendments to try to make their program work a little better. The most recent of these amendments came right before the summer break on June 26th, and at that point the board in your discussion noted a comment from the Planning Board in their recommendations that perhaps it was time to take a step back and look at a more comprehensive view of our affordable housing program and how we might just look at it as a whole rather than little piecemeal corrections. At the same meeting, the board created an affordable housing task force, appointed 3 members to serve, and charged them with coming back with a recommendation to the full board, focusing mainly on policy. Shortly thereafter, the Planning Board, taking advantage of their first effort to promote National Community Planning Month, took up the topic of affordable housing and held a series of 3 dialogue sessions throughout the month of October, which really went over quite well, if I may say. And they focused on pretty much everything but policy. To continue, the task force presented its recommendations to the board in December, and we'll hit those in just a minute. But as part of that discussion, the board requested a future work session to discuss in more detail 3 main topics. One was the task force recommendations related to the ordinance, the results, which at that point were still forthcoming, of the affordable housing dialogue session, and also the possibility of the town pursuing a more active role in either purchasing or somehow retaining affordable housing, taking on a little bit of a different role in the process. Subsequent to that meeting, the Planning Board did present their report, the findings of the affordable housing dialogue sessions, and that's in your packet as a refresher. And also, on a somewhat parallel track, there's been some ongoing conversations, and this came up again just recently, talking about the potential use of the green track and perhaps of an affordable housing component to that as well. The task force has reconvened with Alderman Lavelle taking Dan Coleman's spot. And just before I forget, even though it's somewhat not related to your specific timeline, in April, the middle of April, I think it's the April 16th meeting, you're tentatively scheduled to have a presentation from UNC's Department of City and Regional Planning talking about housing and transportation and affordability. So there's more information coming. Just as a quick refresher, the task force focused their recommendations on 2 distinct areas. One was the payment in lieu option, and second was the small house, the size limited requirement. And it was broken up into 4 specific subcategories, and these are in your packet. This is really for the benefit of the audience as a refresher. The first one really had to do with looking at the affordable housing percentage, maybe reducing the percentage from 15 to 12 and looking at expanding the continuum of income and other ways of providing more flexibility. And these relate, when we always look at consistency, to Vision 2020, and these are our 2 most relevant affordable housing provisions. I've also added, in a very truncated version, Just kind of a tickler of the key 12 recommendations from the Planning Board dialogue session. The full report is in your packet, but just I thought it might be helpful. We have 1 through 6 here and then 1 through 12 or remaining 12 to help refresh if you'd like to use those for reference.
All right, great, thank you. This is a work session meeting, and I should have pointed out, so we don't normally hear public comments, but we have a key public stakeholder that I would like to recognize. It's all right with the Board of Aldermen from the Orange Community Land Trust. If you would come up.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Board of Aldermen. I'm glad to be here this evening. I'm Anita Badrock. I'm the Operations Manager for Community Home Trust, and I'm here tonight. Mr. Dowling, our Executive Director, wasn't able to be here, but did want me to come before you and just, first of all, tell you that this has really been exciting and interesting to see what's been happening here. You know, the Affordable Housing Task Force from the Board of Aldermen have come together to really make some specific recommendations. The Planning Board has pulled together this community dialogue, and a lot of good things have come out of that. And as we looked at this, one of the things we help you implement your affordable home ownership component of your affordable housing strategy. So my comments are really specifically more about that. And the real thing that we would encourage you to do is to really take some time and take a moment to look at some of these specific recommendations that your task force put together, coupled and brought in with the information from those public dialogue sessions to really align those priorities and see and make sure that the things that you're recommending to change your ordinance really align with community interest and will achieve the intended results. I think that's more than anything. One thing that we have learned in working with affordable housing in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and now in Hillsboro, there are some preliminary plans for affordable housing in that area of the county, is that the market's really changed for everybody. It's changed for buyers, what they want to buy, what's important to them. It's changed for developers who develop this, who are your partners in developing this particular kind of housing. And so making sure that your ordinance really incentivizes what you want, I think, is an important thing for you all to consider. And as you move forward, continuing to talk with your community stakeholders and partners, including getting just some maybe preliminary feedback from those who will create your affordable housing, the developers who will create it, about whether these changes really will move them in that direction of creating affordable housing, of choosing that option in your land ordinance, will be important. We know that there's a great demand for affordable housing in Carrboro, and the affordable housing that has been created is beautiful. People like it. They want it, and we'd like to see more of that. But we just want to be sure that the changes that you're proposing, you know, the way that you decided to step back and take a look and gather some community input was really valuable, and we would just encourage you to really look at this in more detail and just be sure that it's achieving the results that you want. Yes.
I know that you and Robert had discussed, and Robert and I also discussed, the number one recommendation, which is reducing the number of affordable units from 15 to 12%, while also reducing the cost of the unit from 80% AMI to 65% area median income. Could you speak a little bit to that? Or
yeah, and I will tell you that our thought about that is that you've had an affordable housing path in your ordinance that developers could have 25% small houses or create affordable housing. And there hasn't been a whole lot of affordable housing created in that path, not as much as you would have hoped. And I don't know if these specific numbers really change the metrics for a developer to push them more in that direction or to make that more attractive to them. And that's the kind of thing that I think getting a little more information on and trying to understand a little better if those changes in those metrics really move it in that direction would be very helpful for you all.
So if we brought in some of the people who have built our larger developments and have operated under these ordinances to kind of say what would happen on the ground if we did this, might be a good way to do it.
I certainly think so. You've had some folks who have done some development here that could be helpful to you in letting you know if this is the kind of change that would really move them in that direction. And I don't know. Because certainly reducing the number of units is something that would probably move them in that direction. But if you reduce the cost of those units that they're purchased from the developer or purchased by the owner, that increases the cost of developing those units. So that trade-off, I don't know if that balance is quite right or not. And I'm not really the best person to speak to that. I think someone with more understanding of development costs is the right person to speak to that.
Okay. Yeah. Anybody else have any questions for Anita right now? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and your whole organization for all that you do for our community. Okay. Michelle, did you have anything you wanted to go ahead?
So I just wanted to update the board about our meeting on Friday. Sammy, Lydia, and I met with Tina staff on Friday, and we have another meeting scheduled for March 28th, where we're hoping to invite Bethany, who is sitting here, who may not know about that.
I do, and I can't attend, but I can designate
somebody. Okay, so we want representation from the planning board and potentially from Transportation Advisory Board because they were involved in the planning board's follow-up. As far as our report that the planning board gave us. And we also want to take time to thank the planning board again for the work that they did with the dialogue sessions and community engagement. And we spent Friday going through all of the recommendations and talked about how our recommendations from our task force aligned with those. And we have a lot more work to do with some of the recommendations. And we pulled a few things for a retreat topic that we can talk about later. One specifically, though, was how transportation impacts affordability, and where does it make sense to have affordable housing, and where do we need to have density, and how does transportation impact that or transit impact that? So we felt like that was a larger topic that we need to follow up on. And there were a few other ideas. Lydia suggested an idea. Is it Ballantyne that has no bus line?
We were trying to think of creative ways to explore transit type options, but we haven't gotten through that a little more yet. But talking about affordability and distance from town and how hard it is, as Robert himself has mentioned, that's what's
right.
Been hard about selling units at Ballantyne.
So we talked about that. We also talked about the and Sammy brought this up. Affordable. I know we're focusing on affordable housing. Sammy brought up affordable commercial space that we can. We thought that was a topic to have maybe at our retreat too. And we talked about having. Understanding the zoning and how things could be zoned so that we could have more affordable options for people. And so that's a staff. We asked Tina to follow up with us about that. And we have other stakeholders that we want to be involved in the task force. Like I said, at the next meeting, TAB and planning board. And I think you have a good suggestion about meeting with the developers. Again, we did that initially at the beginning of our task force. And it seems like going back to them with these recommendations to see if this actually does incentivize them building affordable units or having payment in lieu so that we can do something with affordable housing, that's a good idea that I think we could follow up on. And we wanted the board to talk about 1 through 3 of these recommendations. We wanted to pull number 4.
You can back, everyone.
Back again.
Oh,
no, those are back. Yeah. No. That. There it is.
Oh, right.
We wanted to pull number 4 because we got into a discussion about open space and public, private, and is it really open, and is that what we want to do? And, of course, we can talk about that if y'all want to, but we felt like focusing on 1 through 3 would be better.
Mm-hmm. Right. So one thing was these 4 are what came out of the task force's recommendations we got in December. And so when we looked at all of the additional recommendations from the planning board, we kind of tried to see if there's any complete overlap with these, and certainly with number 4 at open. It opened up the open space kind of conversation. That seemed like one that is part of a larger conversation. But but we thought 1, 2, and 3 were ones that perhaps we could discuss and maybe move forward. And then these other recommendations deal with and on our next meeting and or further expansion of that group.
So is the idea to take these and the list you just went through and have that be like the meat of our retreat? Is that the idea?
I know some of the
that's key, a good idea.
Some of the key concepts we came up with got so big, we thought, gosh, we all need to sit down and talk about.
And
these.
I think the retreat would be a really good place to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of recommendations by the planning board. Fortunately, some of them do overlap with these. So, like the 4th one is number 6 mm-hmm. from the planning board. And then the number 2 from the planning board, which speaks of very low, 50% of medium income to low, 50 to 80% mm-hmm. to moderate, 80 to 115%. This essentially is speaking to the low portion, but there's an opportunity also to be thinking of the other portions, perhaps by thinking of not just new construction and affordable housing that can be achieved through it, but other models that are already represented by some organizations in our town, such as, for example, Weaver Street Co-Housing mm-hmm. Authority, which right. uses existing houses. And, you know, there are different models, so there's an opportunity to compile what those models are and think comprehensively in how to achieve a broader range of affordability. You know, other questions of, yeah, the point of affordable commercial as it relates to the green track, the opportunity, because the small area plan for Chapel Hill describes kind of mixed use there, but the interest in the long history of that tract pointing to the importance of affordable housing specifically for that the 18 acres there. So these two things seem to be happening simultaneously. And then other opportunities, like on our 2020 vision, there's the one that stood out to me is creating a low-interest loan pool for individuals and nonprofits that wish to buy and rehabilitate housing if desired. Mm-hmm. So even from the 2020 vision, we didn't really get into it in our task force, but I think there's an opportunity to think of some of the recommendations as they connect to both the task force and the planning board's points.
And I know only 2 items that we just need to be more educated on and or have more information on to even feel like we can speak to, you know, possible ideas. You know, one was it was related to number 5 of the planning board. We're talked about look at rezoning infill projects and revising perhaps current limitations on or conditions for secondary units. And I'm generally aware of accessory usage and different things like that, but overall we thought it would be good to have a primer on that before we start making suggestions. But it's a very, very valid recommendation and one that we should certainly look at. And then there were 1 or 2 that kind of overlaid with that information-wise, such as identifying different type of land that might be available, different tracts that might be available, and then a biggie to develop a master land use plan, which is one, you know, a lot of these are long-term, but they all go toward the same goal.
Well, I'm glad that Sammy and Lydia brought up not only diversified affordable, but the potential for accessory mm-hmm. units. One of the things that I know that when I was in the dialogue came up were some of the existing spaces infill Granny Flats, and that's something I know Planning Board has talked about for years, that there's citizen interest in looking at models other than new developments. So, you know, if those two, the diversified, affordable, and the rezoning and accessible units could be kind of paired, that would be great.
So I just wanted to add one or two thoughts with respect to this. One is that, you know, I think on number one that, you know, for me, conceptually, the recommendation number one works. But I think it's important not to get too caught up on exactly what the numbers are quite yet.
Right.
And that's where kind of that conversation that Anita was alluding to with some of the developers really needs to happen. So whether it's exactly 12% or whatever, or whether the income limit that we're trying to reach is 65% exactly is, you know, that's the part that we need to have a conversation about. But I think the concept I like a lot. I want to flag for the town attorney in particular the fact that, you know, we normally have in the past relied on 80% of area median income as a threshold. That is a stat that that the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development comes up with. I think I'm remembering this correctly, but I think specifically Housing and Urban Development comes up annually with a figure that's 80% of area median income, a figure that is, I believe the next one down is 50%, and the next one down is 30%. Or anyway, they come up with they have a three-tiered system at Housing and Urban Development. And I guess my point is that we're starting to head, it seems, toward a number that's somewhere between two of the federally defined stats. So I think it'll just be wherever we wind up, whatever that threshold is that we as a group decide we're comfortable with, we need a clear definition of how do you calculate 65% or whatever, because interestingly you might think that 50% of our area median income would be precisely 5/8 of whatever 80% is.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact that is not the way that HUD does it. So in my experience, in my day job, if you will, it often comes down to the precise figures, exactly what is that threshold income. So we just need to make sure that we spell into the ordinance, whatever the change is, exactly how you figure out what 65% is, given that HUD doesn't actually come up with a 65% figure. And, you know, in other words, 65% could be defined as being X number of 7/17 of 80%, or it could be defined as being X number of, you know, a multiplier off of the 50% number or a multiplier off the 80% number. And if it all truly were spelled out in a linear fashion by HUD, it wouldn't make a difference which number you worked off of. But in fact, curiously enough, they don't work on a strictly linear basis. So we just need to be really clear when we get down to the ordinance level about how we're defining 65%.
I know Robert Dowling has spent an incredible amount of time dealing with the HUD numbers, particularly since our AMI is so much more than just Carrboro and Chapel Hill, and it throws everything off, and right. that it hasn't risen as the cost of housing has risen.
And in fact, it's declined because, curiously enough, at one time, our our area for area median income was considered to be Orange and Chatham.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now our area for area median income is considered to be Orange and Durham.
Yeah.
And the income situations in Durham and Chatham County are different enough that it has really kind of it's actually led to a decrease in the eligible numbers. But my point is not exactly what the numbers are, nor which way it ought to be calculated, but it just needs to be spelled out in a really crystal clear way. Do you figure 65% by working down from the 80% number or working up from the 50% number? Because there ends up being a difference, because curiously enough, the numbers are not linear. All right, so I just wanted to put that, flag that for the town attorney. On point number two, I don't have a problem with what point number two says, but I just want to, and I've made this point before, including recently with the Board of Aldermen, but the. It was at a meeting that wasn't broadcast on TV, and the media wasn't present for. So I want to drag it out again, and just make the point that, you know, we have this Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and payments in lieu go into our trust fund for the town of Carrboro. And the reality is that very few payments in lieu have ever been made into our trust fund, and I believe that all of the payments in lieu that have ever been made into the trust fund, all of that money has now been allocated, so that the current situation is that we have no money at all in our Affordable Housing Trust Fund for the town of Carrboro. And the significance I want to attach to that is it often comes up that we have situations where there is somebody who has inherited a house or who has owned a house for a very long time, is maybe now retired and living on little more or, if anything, more than Social Security income, and where that person really needs some assistance in maintaining their home to be able to remain as an owner-occupant in their home. And the Affordable Housing Trust Fund would be and is every now and then a great source of funding to help with those situations. But that right now, because we have allocated all the funds that are in that trust fund, we don't have anything left to help out. And so, for example, there's, without mentioning names or streets or whatever, but there's a family in Carrboro that is living in a house where it's a house that they inherited through their family. They own it outright, but they're extremely low income, and the house is in really deplorable condition. They've got carpet beetles, which are very similar in effect to bed bugs. So that the children and the people who live in the family are being bitten all night long by insects, can't sleep through the night, and this is the kind of situation that would be perfect to address with the trust fund, but we have no money, and so I think it's important for us to make sure that we move away from the situation where we have nothing to work with in our trust fund, where we have no resources left to help out people in these sort of desperate circumstances. And not to disagree in any way with what's recommended in number two, but just to say, let's all bear that in mind, that the reality is that when we accept payments in lieu, We may be losing one unit out of a particular development that could otherwise have happened, but we're also gaining a lot in terms of trying to help out people who are existing owner occupants of affordable homes in our community, and that there's a lot of value to that too. So I think, and I've never, I've said this a couple of times over the last 9.5 years or whatever it's been, but, and I've never come up with a great idea about how to really spell this out, but I think it would be helpful, and I would appreciate if staff could explore this, if we could develop some guidelines that would help guide future members of the Board of Aldermen in deciding when is it appropriate and to what extent is it appropriate to accept payments in lieu as opposed to the affordable housing, you know, because...
So it's consistent.
You know, yeah, exactly. So it's fairly consistent, and so that various developers can feel correctly that they're being treated in an equal manner, so that it doesn't become about
what mood the board was
Right, like what mood the board is in, or whether we like the developer or whether we don't like the developer, but rather whether it makes sense from some public policy point of view. It would really be helpful to have some guidelines, not necessarily. They don't have to be absolute and hard and fast, but just some a list of considerations that we'll take into account when we decide whether or not to accept a payment in lieu. And number two suggests actually one criterion that could be a part of that, which is no more than X percent of the affordable housing requirement might be met by payment in lieu. Anyway,
I think that would also help the planning board in reviewing plans if they had the same guidelines as to when it would be appropriate and starting at that level.
And of course, it'll inevitably turn out that you can never really contemplate every scenario and every possibility. But I just think it would be helpful to have some guidelines or some principles or something articulated as kind of the basis for deciding when it is that we do or don't accept a certain amount of payment in lieu.
So the way I read it right now is it just says allow for payments in lieu minimum of 5%. So what you're recommending is that we should probably add some more description to that, because it's pretty broad right now.
Right. I mean, just so that when the Board of Aldermen accepts payments in lieu in the future, that we'll have some reason why, you know, because this the situation with this particular development is, you know, and maybe it's something as simple as, you know, all the units in this development are proposed to be one bedroom, and we only need so many one bedroom units, you know, and that there's the needs are so much more diverse than that we want, you know, or I don't know, but it just seems to me that it would be helpful for us to have some adopted guidelines or some kind of guideline for. Mm-hmm.
So do you see that as a retreat topic?
I don't know. What I would really love is for the staff to give some thought to that and to try and, you know, put a kind of a straw person out there as far as what those guidelines might look like and mm-hmm. maybe have this board react to them. Anyway, this seems to me something to give us some basis for deciding one way or another in the future whether or not we do or don't.
So I agree. That would be good to have some guidelines. And it seems like there are a few follow-up points. So I'm wondering if we'd want those guidelines actually before we got to a retreat, if that's possible. We haven't scheduled a retreat, just so that we're being really clear about how we might want to change the affordable housing strategy instead of having brainstorming session there about guidelines. So there's that question. I don't have a question for staff about how long that would take without any expectation attached to that. And then it seems like our task force needs to go back and both meet with the developers and meet with Robert or staff from the Community Home Trust and meet with TAB and planning. Those are some follow-up steps for us. And I would think those need to happen before the retreat as well for us to really get there and do some work around what this is going to look like as far as a strategy.
So. And I would add, not just with the Home Trust, but that we
Well, other people,
I,
yeah.
That would be those more broad, were just the, yeah, to make sure we're representing the diversity of ways in which affordable housing is achieved.
Mm-hmm. How will you determine which builders, developers you want to...
Well, we met with developers before. It seems like bringing those people back again. I don't know how...
folks who...
You sent out a broad invitation to
folks who've actually developed in recent years. Yeah. I mean, that would be my question.
And who've made affordable housing part of their...
Well, can you,
or didn't.
Can you
or
say who, just a little yeah. bit about who was
folks who may
there?
Do more construction.
We said that we're not.
Yeah, we invited folks who, developers who had provided, included in their projects or committed to including in their projects, so they'd sort of participated in the conversation, understood the regulations and all, affordable units they'd considered either this, you know, taking the size limited provisions beyond just providing size limited and going with affordables instead. So that was the group of folks we invited. And we invited realtors who were associated with those projects, projects that had been approved. Some of the projects had units constructed and others are still permits that have not advanced to construction. And we invited, I mean, Robert Dowling, the Home Trust, was also represented. Mm-hmm. In the conversation, so that
and
was...
these recommendations came from that meeting. I mean, they came from what the developers were saying, mm-hmm. just to speak to incentivizing them to do something.
The task force developed its recommendations after
that
the
conversation.
Meeting. Yeah.
And so just the last thing I wanted to say is let's connect number one and number three, or let's at least consider connecting number one and number three, which is... You know, number three says retain the density bonus only for built units as an incentive to provide more houses and make fewer payments in lieu, which I think makes a lot of sense. But let's connect the dots there, because right now there's already there can be situations where there is a slight disconnect mm-hmm. because to give an example right now, and this is going to be kind of over the top because these kind of numbers don't usually come up. But for example, if someone were owned a piece of land or had a piece of land where theoretically 100 units could be developed, then if they built 15% affordable housing, that they could build up to 150 units. So to build 15%, excuse me, no, this is the thing. This is the thing is they can build up to 150 units as long as half of the bonus units are affordable housing. So half of the bonus units in that situation amounts to 25. 25 is slightly more than 15% of 150. That is say, half the if the base density would allow 100, the bonus units would be 50. Half of the bonus units would be 25, but 15% affordable would be 22.5, or in other words, 23. Hmm. My point being that to get the full benefit of the bonus right. in that situation, you're actually building more than the 15% that's sort of the community's expectations. Let me put it that
on
way.
The initial number.
Based upon not just based upon the initial number, but based even upon the total bonus number. Mm-hmm. 25% is more than right. 15% of 150. I don't want to get into graphing the curve to try and explain all this, but just to point out that there's something that's just slightly off about that right. in terms of the relationship between the number of bonus units in order to take advantage
right.
of the 50% affordable housing density bonus, blah blah blah, and as you fade from 15% to 12%. And from 80% of area median income back to 65, those numbers start to get even further out of whack.
Right.
Anyway, just to say, let's, again, we'll throw it into the attorney's court and just say, let's just keep an eye on that ball and just say that the internal logic of the policy versus what's actually called for in the ordinance needs to be, those two things, it just seems to me, need to be kind of harmonized in some way. Without, and we'll let
when you lay overlay
the lawyers do the calculus
on it, it does, it can skew the numbers.
It's off right now, is what I'm saying. But the way it's off is very slight. But with the kind of changes that are contemplated in number one, the numbers start to get off further and further. So I'm not sure. What conclusion we ought to draw, but just that somehow the policy and the ordinance ought to line up.
It's an important red flag for what you need to watch for if you look to change the metric.
Yes.
There you go. This is really kind of the implication of it all. So anyway, so somehow if the attorney could, I'm not sure whether our town attorneys are really excellent at math or not, but
so you'll be getting into trouble if you have us doing all the math. We'll have help from people.
Okay, you can
subcontract that part out. I don't know, but the point being that somehow we just need to kind of look at how those two interact and make sure that they're not working at odds in any way. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of come back to an earlier question when we said some of these decisions or some of these discussions we'd like to have be a part of our retreat. And in particular, of the joint recommendations from Planning Board and the TAB, mm-hmm. number 3 and number 6, those were ones that seemed really big, really broad, ones that we all, you know, would want to dialogue about. Number 3 had to do with transportation costs and how those relate to affordable housing. And the more we talked about it, the more we saw the three of us even just had a lot to say about it. Number 6 was looking at longstanding policies, but in particular that one talked about the open space and recreation space requirement. Those two were the two in particular, I think, that we wanted to pull out and try to talk about at our retreat.
Okay. All right, anything further on this item right now?
Thank everybody that's worked so hard on it. Thank the task force. And Dan, if you're streaming, thank you. I hope it's cooled down. I heard it was real hot in Australia. Sure, yeah. But thanks for your work on this, Dan.
Yeah. It probably is to you. All right. Okay.
Except do we want to direct staff to come back with some guidelines for us around the...
Yeah, we didn't move that as an action item.
Okay, I'm moving it. Do we need the staff to do other things?
It's
related to this.
Bring us at whatever retreat we might schedule some proposed guidelines for deciding about payments in lieu.
I was wondering if we could actually look at that.
If this is the only topic for the retreat, it's great. If we have other topics, it's going to be hard to get to. We're going to talk about guidelines and not actually get to the core of the recommendations, I think.
Okay, what else do you want to say then?
I wanted to know if it's reasonable for them to bring it back before a retreat. We have not scheduled a retreet, though.
They can definitely bring it back before... non-scheduled event.
I have your April 9th for the date for you to discuss the board retreat, and I think you're probably looking at June.
Yeah. What was the date last year?
It was June 23rd last year.
Is that unreasonable?
No, I think we can pull together guidelines on this before the end of this season.
Well, I'm asking though if you can do it like at the begin before the retreat because we'll probably
meet. No, I think
that's okay. Cool. So okay. I'm moving that we direct the staff.
The other item that we may want to include is number 7, which is actually calling for a map, and if we're going to review that, would make sense to have something.
Remind me, a map of what?
All vacant and non-revenue generating publicly and privately owned land, including parking lots, and identify tracts available for affordable housing or commercial uses that support affordable housing.
Planning staff.
I was I wasn't completely listening.
The question of having a map with item number 7 represented.
It's just up there.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, matter passed unanimously. That brings us to an update on changes to the Orange County Recycling Program.
Mr. Mayor, last Thursday, March 7th, the county staff introduced a plan to explore a franchise agreement process for the unincorporated areas of Orange County, which would include the privatization of curbside household solid waste and recycling, the impact of the changes to the recycling program for Carrboro residents would be the elimination of Orange County's curbside recycling collection as of July 1, 2014. The economic impact, if the Carrboro residents were to have to, if taxpayers would have to assume that cost, would be about $300,000.
What's their thinking behind this? I mean, do you know? And what's going to happen to the employees? And what's going to happen to people? What's going to happen when people go, no, I don't want to pay extra for it. I'm already paying my tax bill. Right. I'm just throwing it somewhere else. This recycling program that has put us in the forefront, not just in the state, but in the nation for our recycling efforts, to privatize that? I mean, this isn't Michigan. I just find that shocking. Shocking, and to be coming from the county, it's like, really
incredible.
Do you, David? Do you have some? Do you have some kind of presentation or some kind of
highlights
you're going to? Or is this just a general discussion?
You know, I think our timing is good because we kind of knew this was had heard it was coming from the county, and it's the result of a some type of lawsuit, which I don't know if you're.
You've all heard about the Landvale decision, which was really
no.
Decision.
This is the one they've referenced a few times.
Landvale, L-A-N-V-A-L. It's a North Carolina Supreme Court case decided back in the end of 2012, which the import of it, although it had nothing to do with recycling or solid waste or collection of fees associated with those kinds of programs, what it was about was the court very narrowly interpreting statutes giving local governments authority to do things. And the county has, I think as a result of Landvale and as a result of the pending closure of the landfill, looked at all their programs and realized that perhaps the way they were operating their recycling program under the statutory authority given to counties might not be as clear as we had thought it was before Landvale. So I think they're now rethinking whether they have authority to carry out the program the way they've been carrying it out in the past. And they're exploring alternatives because I think they're afraid that some other court, if this program were challenged, some other court would apply Landvale and say, wait a second, there's no statutory authority for the way you're doing it. Hence their review of the program now.
Well, how about just regular waste collection?
The statutory authority for regular solid waste collection is clear, but the problem has to do in the county enabling legislation. There's clear authority for counties to have solid waste programs. It's not so clear about their authority to have recycling programs and how they can charge or pay for recycling programs. Conversely, or in the alternatively, for towns, for local governments, under Chapter 168 of the General Statutes, there is clear authority for
a recycling component to your solid waste program. And that has caused the county, I think, to have some pause.
Wow.
And how does this compare? Is this related to SAFO, the kind of hesitancy there was around SAFO, too?
Well, I think the Landvale case was about adequate public facilities, and this is kind of related to this, our discussion about SAFO before.
So what strikes me is that SAFO seemed to be, our response to that case seemed to be rushed, and fortunately we took a step back and we're holding off on that, and it seems even more directly related than this connection is. So it amazes me to see kind of the urgency with which the county is moving forward on over-interpreting perhaps a case that's far removed. And I would very much encourage the county to take a step back. And I was shocked to see their last meeting where they just basically went ahead with what the manager proposed out of an unfounded fear of time running out. We need to really take advantage and look at this with some time and not throw out the window such an invaluable program as a recycling program is. So I don't know how we want to signal that. I would hope as a board that we could speak to the county and make a statement to that effect. I'm really worried, too, that as governments who have collaborated in the past, we're not really having a clear channel or space within which to collaborate as we move forward. Already we've lost the landfill. That was pretty unilateral, but to now lose our recycling in the way it is really concerning. So if the board is willing, if we could tailor some kind of statement to convey to the county our concern.
I just want some clarity on something.
Go ahead.
Is the issue that the county was, in this case, was unfairly competing with the private sector? That wasn't the issue.
That wasn't the issue. The issue really was the statutory authority for, whether there was clear statutory authority or not for the county to implement the program the way they have been for however many years.
The 3R fee, in other words.
Right. And yeah. Just to be clear, I mean, the Landvale case, and I don't want to overemphasize this, but if the reasoning of the Supreme Court majority in that case is applied broadly, that is across the range of services, it could have pretty significant implications.
On other services,
sure,
as well?
But we don't know if they're doing it.
But we just don't know at this
So why do we preempt ourselves?
We believe, and we hope as practitioners, we hope that it is a narrow to the zoning power kind of interpretation of will be applied.
Okay. Let me, if I may, I would like to recognize Terry Buckner to address the board briefly.
Hi, this has been my past 2 days looking into this, and I think the problem might be in the way the 3R fee is being calculated, that part of it is done as an assessment and part of it is done as a tax. So what we have is a funding problem, and what they are proposing, privatization, is a collection solution.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm here to ask you, please, to stand up to the county and say, no, we want to keep our recycling program the way it is, and let's find another solution. This problem is affecting 13,000 of those of us who are in the unincorporated rural areas. And it comes out, the fee that we're being charged comes out to be about $6.50 a month. There's no way we will ever get a privatized system that for that cheap. If we lose this, we lose all of the schools are going to have to start paying. It's going to affect you and the cities. The manager is just moving too quickly on this. They're having a budget meeting tonight, and he's zeroed out the capital improvement program funds for the recycling program. So it's kind of like he's treating this as a done deal, and I am asking you to please be the barrier. We've worked hard on this program, and we can't lose it. There's got to be some other solutions. So thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks, Terry.
All right. Mr. Mayor, there's a real simple solution to it all. And that was in your staff report, and that would be really for the town to advocate that Orange County continue to fund the recycling program as it is and raise their property tax rate, and nothing changes. It's that simple. It could be that simple.
Just to jump on top of that, all the attorneys representing the county and the local governments in Orange County, we met and discussed this issue back maybe about 6 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago. And certainly those of us who are representing local governments, Carrboro, Hillsborough, and Chapel Hill, all came to the same conclusion, is that the program could remain exactly the way it is if the county would just say, we're going to pay for it through general taxes rather than through an assessment. And so that was a suggestion we made on as the lawyers.
It's really minimal, right?
Well, I don't know what the exact dollar amounts are, but it's almost shifting – just shifting the way you're paying for it from an assessment. The money, the dollar amounts don't change, just how you collect the dollar changes, perhaps from whom you collect it to some extent.
So just to explore this for a moment so that we have, like, the flavor of the difference between the funding system, that the kind of funding system you're talking about, the kind of funding system that we're currently under. Right now, the way the 3R fee works is that if you have a single-family home, you pay a certain amount. And if you are in a multifamily home, so, for example, if you own a townhome or a condominium, you pay a different fee. And I think there's also a difference between rural and urban because you know, if you live out off a Hatch Road, you only get service twice a week, or once every 2 weeks, as opposed to once a week in town. So there's some difference between rural and urban fee, and there's also a difference between the amount that that owners of multifamily units pay is lower than for single family units, detached houses. If it were paid for out of the county's general fund, then the amount that you pay would be attached, would be a function of the value, the tax value of your home. So, for example, you know, right now, let's say if you live on, I don't know, like on Lloyd Street, your house, and you live in a single family house, your house might be valued at $150,000. And you pay X amount. If you live on Stratford Drive in Carrboro, where your house is valued at 3, 4, possibly even 5 times as much, you pay the same amount that a single-family home on Lloyd Street does. If the funding structure for our recycling program were changed so that it was paid for out of general fund, then it would be related strictly to value, so that somebody on Lloyd Street would be paying only a quarter as much as somebody on Stratford Drive.
So it would be better?
Well, depends on whether you live on Lloyd Street or whether you live on Stratford Drive.
It's
a question. Well, it'd be a more progressive form of paying for the system in order to link it to the value of the real estate. For the most part, generally speaking, there could be some examples of situations where the reverse would be the case because, for example, there are some people who live, let's say, if you live in one of the townhomes that are in Lake Hogan Farms, for example, the values on those properties are considerably higher than the average value of a home in Carrboro more generally, or than various multifamily houses. So, for example, the amount that somebody who lives in Lake Hogan Farms in one of the town houses there might be, the effective amount that they might be paying might go up for them.
And you could see that three different townhomes, depending upon where they are, if they're Canterbury or they're Rosewalk or they're Lake Hogan Farms, could be paying different.
Mm-hmm. Or Abbey Court.
Right, exactly.
For example, that right now, whether you're at Rosewalk or Abbey Court, you're paying the same amount. But
right.
Under this change, it would then relate to value, so
it'll
that somebody at Rosewalk might the effective cost to them might be considerably higher mm-hmm. compared with what Abbey Court residents might be paying, because at Abbey Court your tax value is probably in the range of like $40,000, and at Rosewalk it's probably $300,000+. So the difference could be very significant.
And then isn't there an issue, too, with rural, if you go through the property tax avenue, wouldn't there be an unfair allocation there?
That would be a significant, that could well be a significant difference. And in fact, it would be a significant difference, especially depending on exactly where you live. So, for example, my mother, I mentioned off of Hatch Road, my mother lives off out of Hatch Road. She only gets service every 2 weeks. On recycling, versus somebody in town gets, at least under our present system, gets service every week. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for comparably valued houses, she'd only be getting half the service mm-hmm. that somebody in town would be getting. And, you know, there are quite a few numerically it might be a small percentage, but there are lots of houses in rural Orange County. You know, a good 10-15% of the residents of Orange County don't get any curbside recycling service because where they live is such a rural location that it's not cost effective to give them curbside service. So anyway, I'm pointing that out so that we have all kind of the facts on the table.
Which also raises the questions of the convenience centers and the upkeep of having the convenience centers for the county and also for the municipalities.
So. Well, you know, I guess my personal perspective on that would be that if all of this stuff, if all the various recycling services were being paid for through our county taxes, that it would be a more fair system in that, you know, people who live in more rural areas would be contributing in a more fair way to the cost of those rural convenience centers.
Right.
You know, for most of us, you know, there's a recycling center on Ford Road in rural Orange County, mm-hmm. 4 miles west of Carrboro, that most people in Carrboro get, you know, very little. Very seldom do any of us in Carrboro ever use that site. I'm not trying to pick on that site, but just as an example, there are many others. Anyway, but here's the real thing: is that I basically somebody marked down this date. I really agree with what Terry has to say. On the whole, you know, the question. It really isn't even a question of how we should pay for it. It's not even a question of how we should pay for it. It's a question of that this is a service that residents of our town, and I think residents of the county in general, benefit from tremendously and that we value a lot and that we want to see continue. And, you know, if there's a problem with the funding mechanism, then please, Orange County Commissioners, find a solution to the problem other than cutting the program, you know, let's figure it out.
In other words, I don't want to prescribe
what that solution ought to be. I mean, I have an opinion, but I don't want to try and prescribe what that solution ought to be. But just to say, look, this is highly valued by people in our community. County commissioners, there are a number of possibilities. Please find a solution and have that solution be that we're all going to continue to get this important service.
Yeah, I think I would recommend that we generate a letter urgently to the commissioners, stating our unequivocal support for continuation of recycling services in the municipalities in Orange County. Because I really see this as, throwing down the gauntlet of an interest in privatization as a maneuver to get us to do exactly this. Yeah. To get us to generate a letter so that we're asking that it comes out of the general fund. And if they hadn't thought of it, then at least they know that we want to sit down and hammer this out, because we are completely committed to the recycling program.
Is that a motion?
So it is.
Can I just speak to that? I mean, what is shocking to me is that I saw their meeting, and it's not that they didn't consider it. Every single person that came up and spoke begged them to consider alternative options.
Right.
And they just couldn't hear that, and they went along with the process proposed by their manager, which sets the course for this franchise agreement. So, I mean, for me, what has to happen is that they should really, like, wake up and recognize that they're not representing the people. They're representing their manager. And they need to cancel that public hearing and instead have a public hearing on what is underlying, what's the underlying problem, and what are the various options. And at the same time, continue funding the recycling. I mean, what Terry just mentioned today, of their zeroing out the recycling, we weren't warned about that. And just zeroing it out, is this total disregard for not just the rural folks, but the urban folks, us. And they need to continue funding that so that we at least buy time so we can have the appropriate discussion to sustain this program.
Other thing that people aren't talking about, and this happens whenever you privatize something, this is a system that we have built over the past over 30 years with both our money but also our goodwill. And a private hauler would not be able to come in. Think of the advertising and the public outreach and the education and all of that that a private hauler would have to put in place in order to make money off of this. And instead, we're handing them potentially the best market in the state for what they're providing. We are a community that, all the kids recycle without even thinking about it, know? Mm-hmm. So we would be handing this ready-made market. And then I wonder about, well, what about our equipment?
Ready-made market, but ready-made by
that's what I'm saying, by us,
by our tax
that's
dollars,
right.
And by our efforts.
Exactly.
And our,
so it's once again, and there's this move to privatize public goods, which on the surface can sound, but it's really taking what we have paid for and developed and handing it over and paying somebody on top of that to take it away from us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge philosophical difference. And I, like you, I'm very surprised to see the county commissioners on the other side of that philosophical conversation.
The other thing that we haven't mentioned tonight is the franchise would be an opt-in. So, and I think there are studies that show that participation in those kinds of programs. I mean, maybe in Orange County because we have invested but still, it's going to be way less than what we currently have. So it is contrary completely to the underlying philosophy we have in this county. And in this
so if you forget to pay your $260, do your bottles stay out front that week? Or?
Something like that,
I think the question Sammy's raising about how what's happening with the budget and the way solid programs are being dismantled in order I don't know what they're replacing it with, but tight infrastructure in solid waste and recycling, those budgets are being cut completely, and that's the basis of what the county has been providing in complete alignment with the values of the county. So, I mean, to me, it raises a greater question of not only who are you representing, but why are you dismantling things that we have taken so long to build? What is your goal? Is it to you know, enhance a budget, you know?
And what about the staff? I mean, there are people whose entire careers have been spent building this amazing recycling program. I don't think that any private firm would, you know, maybe some of them are ready to retire, and that's why this is happening. I don't know. But
no, at this meeting, none of the staff who are involved spoke about dismantling their system, strangely enough.
No. I mean, what would happen to the staff?
They may be starting to feel like they're ready to retire as these things are happening. Well, let me say this. I think, Jackie, the point you're raising is an important one to you. And some of our current recycling program is contracted out to private companies. And some of it is done in-house through our county government, and I literally was just on Facebook the other day commenting on this point. But I think, you know, if anything, that we ought to be moving in the other direction.
Exactly.
That when it comes to solid waste management, that more and more it ought to be about having public employees perform the role, and that Town of Carrboro has already been working on this issue, but we need to recognize that solid waste management is one of the most difficult and dangerous jobs there is out there. It's solid waste management is actually rated by the federal agency that OSHA says that solid waste management is the fourth most dangerous occupation in the United States of America, behind like forestry, mining, and fisheries. And it is sadly, whether you're talking private sector or public sector, it's one of the lowest paid jobs out there, and that we need to, if anything, be moving exactly in the opposite direction and recognizing that this is an absolutely, that solid waste management is one of the three, possibly the number one most critical function of town governments and city governments across the nation, and that the service that people who work in solid waste collection and in recycling provide that's one of the most critical public health functions. It is the most critical public health function, really, that our municipal governments provide, and that, you know, heading down the path of putting that into the hands of the private sector, where the employees will be paid less and less and exposed to greater and greater dangers, is exactly wrong. It may make sense from a sort of capitalistic point of view, but in terms of what's fair and what's right and what's sort of good for our society and what recognizes people's role and the value of their role in our community, it's exactly wrong. So, yeah. Anyway, it's been moved and seconded.
Just one more question to the manager. Did we find out if they canceled their, I presume they have, the single stream recycling bin that we were all very in favor of the last time we met as an assembly of governments?
Well, yeah, what implications does this hold with respect to?
I think it's been on hold, hasn't it, George? The Orange County's put that on hold.
Yeah. But again.
Could I squeeze in one other question? Do you want to make reference to the swab in the letter or the premature?
Let's not dilute it, I guess.
You mentioned it a little bit.
Yeah.
I think
we're all in agreement about the need for the swab.
I'd just like to note that Barry was averse to it, but if the manager is now speaking in favor of it, it might actually happen. So,
I would recommend a separate letter in response to
swab.
And I really think that you know, one of the things that really irks me about this is that the county's move to ship out the waste and to hand it off. Where is this mindset coming from? And we really need to push back strong because that's not where we've come from on this. And it's not the mentality that we support. In fact, when Mark talks about going the other way, we work very hard in a sustainability mindset of taking responsibility for what we generate. And yet I'm seeing at the county level, you know, the idea of shipping it out and handing it off is becoming more too commonplace.
Wait a minute. I think that when it comes to why the county's in the position of shipping it off, we all bear that responsibility evenly. And I can hear the county listening to those remarks and going, yeah, where was Carrboro when we were siting the landfill? How close to Carrboro do you want it? How? So I think
it's almost better not to go there.
Yeah, when it comes to this issue, I kind of agree. Okay. But man, we are all responsible for the.
Well, let's have this letter be kind of laser focused on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been moved and I think seconded, I guess, by Sammy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed are passed unanimously. And Mr. Manager, if you would, it's sort of incidental to this point, but if you would find a way to make a point to communicate to all those who work in our solid waste collection system for the town of Carrboro some of the points that I was making in terms of how much they are valued by our Carrboro town government and how much all of us on the Carrboro Board of Aldermen appreciate the hard work that they do for our town. I think we would all appreciate that.
We'll do.
All right.
And the state.
All right, that brings us to item B3, discussion of town commons use policy.
Matt has a staff report. You going to report on that?
No.
I'll just give a quick rundown.
We actually do not have a staff report on this item. We just provided the information to the board with the help of Recreation and Parks and Annette putting this information out there. This is the current practices and policies for the town commons, and we wanted to open it up to the board to discuss how they would like to see things done differently, if at all, and any changes you would like to make.
I read through a lot of it. I can't say I read all of it because there was a lot of information. It seems to me that the reason this is before us is that there's a need to change, or there's a request to change the alcohol use. On the last page?
No, ma'am, that was one piece that was added into the conversation. This is in response to earlier comments from the board on how we can streamline the process and make it easier for people to make use of the town commons. And so the direction to the staff was to find the information, how things are currently being done, and allow the board to kind of chew on that and see if there's anything you would like to change about the process as it is now.
But alcohol is a part of that. Also.
That is
okay.
Part of it.
And on that point, the man who knows a lot about alcohol, Tyler Huntington, I shouldn't have gone there, I'm sorry, is here tonight. I would like to ask Tyler to come up and just address the board briefly about that particular aspect of this issue.
I, a little while ago, suggested or just asked Annette about if we could change this policy at all so we could make more use of the commons for different events that I'm, you know, we've got restaurants in other cities, and we're seeing really cool events taking place that are drawing all age ranges, families, you know, all kinds of stuff, and helping local, you know, getting local businesses involved in them at the same time. And some of them are on private land and some of them are on public land. And this would be a great use, I think, and kind of fit into sort of what I see a lot of about Carrboro. If we can host beer festivals or wine festivals or food and beer experiences or food and wine experiences or anything else there that we currently can't do because of the way the policies are. And I don't know exactly what all the legal, whether it's the insurance reasons or what behind it. I know on some other events that we've co-hosted with people, we've had to take out, you know, one-day, million-dollar alcohol policies and name, you know, X city or X business additionally insured, that kind of thing, so that we were able to do that. And what I would love to see something here, you know, this is not really something I'm necessarily promoting as kind of my business, Tyler's, but something that I could really see a lot of Carborough businesses being able to be involved in. You know, like the Tiff Merritt concert, I think, was a great event. And it kind of made me think that we could do a lot more stuff like that. But where the town, and I don't know whether they incurred expense with that or not, but that they wouldn't have to incur any expense if they just got local businesses involved in it, where, you know, we're out there vending food and beer and promoting and that kind of stuff. You know, it probably would make it a little more difficult for them to be free events. There might have to be a fee involved with it if it's a beer festival. Or recently we co-hosted at DPAC with another local Durham business, a food and beer experience, where we brought in 20 local Durham restaurants and 20 North Carolina breweries, and we paired them together. So each table, we had paired them previously, and the chefs got to work with the brewers. And so they had dishes specifically, you know, little sampling plates that were paired with those beers. And it was just little samples, so it's not like it's people getting too much, you know, too drunk or anything like that. And it was really fun. And we had a blast, and people really appreciated being able to combine those things and kind of have a new experience and see this. And that just, to me, sort of appeals to, you know, as we're getting local breweries here, we have local distilleries here, we've got a meadery out in Pittsburgh. Just lots of neat stuff going on that we can't really utilize this great facility right here for.
Thanks, Tyler. All
right. Thanks, Tyler.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler, for that. And my comments aren't gonna go specifically to what Tyler talked about with alcohol, which I actually think there's probably some way we could figure out a way to have these kind of events. But my comments go more to just someone who has worked on lots of major events in the past in Durham. I was really involved with, you know, the Blues Festival, the Bembe Festival, the West Point Eno Festival. You know, my experience of being involved with big special events. And I'm not against them at all in our town. I think I've seen, maybe all have, over the last year and year and a half, probably a lot of it's with the coming of Annette and David, a little increase in some of these events that we're having. And I just want us to be cognizant of the fact that our staff is still the same number that they were before in terms of public works, police, recreation and parks. And I say this again, not to dissuade us at all, but we might need to, and I'm sure staff has probably thought of this also, but we might need to think of new kind of models for putting on these types of special events where we not only recoup our cost, but somehow don't burn out our staff constantly on them, because I'm all for all of these events, but I want us to and I'm sure, Mr. Manager, you all have thought about this, too, as we've come up with these new really neat events on how they're going to work. I mean, I think these are wonderful for the town. They bring in people to spend money and to see our town and to help us out. But I'm also, you know, we have a small, really great group of staff, and I just want to make sure that we don't burn them out too much.
That's a good point. Go ahead, Michelle.
I agree with you, Lydia, and appreciate that Tyler was here and want us to think creatively about events that could happen. And I have a question about whether alcohol changes the amount of enforcement we would have in an event or not. I don't know.
I think it would, but
Carolyn is here. Like, does it change the number of police people who would need to be there if there's alcohol at the event?
As a general statement, yes, but she can be more specific.
Well, yeah, it's sort of, I mean, it speaks to what you're...
like, clearly, at some level, but...
How much?
A little staff coordination going on for just a moment here.
Sorry.
It's okay. Quite all right. Staff coordination is good.
I think that when the people putting on the event expect, say, 300 people, if they're serving alcohol, we require that two off-duty officers work. So if we were to consider other events, my suggestion would be that if alcohol were served, that we come up with some sort of standard, and it may be that standard, you know, for the town commons as well.
And who pays for the off-duty officers to be there in those situations? Like, if that comes up currently at the Century Center, if somebody wanted to serve wine at a
yes,
home screen.
Yes, whoever it is who is sponsoring the event pays the officers.
Okay, so it's not a question of what it costs the town of Carterville.
No, and it's off-duty officers. So, you know, unless there is an incident that's larger than the off-duty officers can deal with, it really doesn't have an impact on the on-duty staff.
Right.
And Carolyn, to that point of it being off-duty officers, it's, of course, I presume, at their discretion, at their willingness, if they're available, they can
yes.
volunteer. And so it wouldn't be a concern in the regard, like, if it were taking up staff time, that's their free time choice.
Yes, that's true.
If for some reason, well, we have a lot of police, but imagining that no one was available in the Carborough Police Force, we could, in theory, hire someone from the Chapel Hill off duty. Or is that restricted currently to Carborough?
I think we would be able to do that. We've got mutual aid relationships mm-hmm. and agreements yeah. with them. So, yes, I think we could do that. We would probably have to make a special request for a particular event and delineate some parameters for that event, but I think it's doable.
And are we kind of far from that as a concern? I mean, do we have kind of depth in availability of off-duty police officers currently?
We do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question, and I don't know if this is for Kevin or for David. Or when we have alcohol at the Century Center, do we require the liability insurance?
I'm sure we did, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Carolyn. That's fine. And just like the question, I guess, that Sammy was asking Carolyn, I'd be interested to hear from, well, I don't know if George is still here or not, but I know we always hear from you when we hear about road races and, you know, the impact on staff, and just wanted that perspective also from Public Works in terms of these special events.
So far with the number of events we have the depth to do that. I think the concern for us starts running in when we have multiple events in a weekend, because mm-hmm. then it kind of stretches us thin. That's kind of initially trying to get people to work multiple days in a row and so forth. So that's the first thing. You know, when we're reviewing events, we like to suggest that they get at least spread out in that respect. But we've been able to manage so far, and I think we can continue to manage.
George, is there an off-duty equivalent with Public Works? Like the police force has off-duty officers made available sometimes for events?
No, I don't think there is, but I think you know, some of the things we've talked about in supplementing, whether you know, we can either get temp workers, seasonal laborers, that type of things, that brings some challenges also. It's nice having your own staff who knows your equipment, mm-hmm. knows the routines and so forth, and trying to incorporate others to do that. It's not impossible, but I don't think we've identified anything yet where we could do that, but that's something certainly if we get to that point we can look at.
Mm-hmm. So do people get comp time when they, or do they like work Saturday so they don't work Monday? How does that work as far as?
Well, we pay according to the Fair Labor Standards Act. So if they work more than 80 hours in that period, they're entitled to time and a half.
Yes. A period is 2 weeks.
Yes. 1 week, sorry, 40 hours, yes.
40 hours in 1 week.
So if they work more than 40 hours, then they get, is it more money or more time, or time off?
What they work, they have, typically give them a choice. They can take it as comp time or they can take it as pay.
Okay.
Well, I know, thanks, George. I know, like, when I was at Parks and Recreation, we always had a lot of, that's like, I guess, the third big group of folk that might be impacted by more special events. We always had a lot of extra part-time staff that we could call on to ebb and flow with the bigger events and smaller type events. So I think with Recreation and Parks, we have a little more flexibility maybe than with Public Works. I know we do this, but now with the upcoming year, it might be. I'm sure that staff will be like looking at a fall festival, spring festival, or a fall music event, spring music event, summer. You know,
street thing.
They'll be. You know, these are two or three events we've had that are great that we didn't even know about a year ago. But now it'll be part of being built into, I guess, the upcoming year and with the planning and the budgeting and the work time planning with everyone.
I would just say that with all that's been happening in Carrboro, you know, and with the National Endowment for the Arts, and I think that, you know, arts and entertainment is a big push as part of our local economic development efforts, that being able to staff from an operational level, being able to staff all these events has probably been my primary concern. I think it has been of Parks and the Police Department and Public Works, and we're very sensitive to that. I realize there have been some times where we've probably pushed folks to the limit, but so far we've been able to manage, but I think we're probably reaching a tipping point. But conversely, we've also looked at opportunities, as you mentioned, where perhaps we could get, say, police officers from Chapel Hill or other jurisdictions similar to what UNC does for football games. I've also spoken with, like, Caremore Health Services, McLaren Parking. There are they do, you know, have folks that are willing to work and can do some of the labor for some of these events. So we have options in addition to town staff, because we don't want to burn our town staff out.
Mark, I have a question.
Go ahead.
I'm wondering if, David, you might be able to prepare, a report to us that gives us an idea by events. Because in the last couple of years, that's exactly right. The nature of events has really escalated, and we're really moving into, the national spotlight. I mean, it's become Destination Carrboro, which is a great thing. But I think it also changes, the question about staff time and how it's allocated and, so I'd love to see by events and where staff feels that it's event heavy as opposed to being neutral or at best even. In addition, where staff might feel that there, if there are resources that staff needs that we're not identifying ahead of time.
Okay.
In the anticipation of how things are changing.
Sure.
One of the problems with being on this side of the desk is we certainly know a lot, but there's a lot that we don't know. And I know there's a reticence on the part of staff when we say, oh, let's do this cool thing, to tell us,
right.
And particularly when you get away from upper management and you get down to the folks that are like out there doing the work, they may not be in a position to say to their managers, hey, man, I'm burnt out. Mm-hmm. And we go along thinking everybody's really happy. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be that person. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody on this board wants to be that person. Mm-hmm. So if we say something that's going to burn out staff, I think Lydia is absolutely right.
and thank her for her sensitivities, that it's so easy for us to not know.
Right.
And I don't want to be like that, and nobody else does. So, you know, it's fine to tell us no, right? And so if we come up with, like, the best idea ever, it's fine to say, you know the book Yertle the Turtle? I think Yertle the Turtle is the best political allegory that I know of, you know, where Yertle keeps piling up and up and till little Mac on the bottom burps and Yertle's just king of the mud. I love Yertle the Turtle, and I don't want to be Yertle the Turtle. So, you know, if we're piling on too much on people, it's fine to tell us.
Push back. Well, go ahead and push back.
Yeah.
Well, let me say, you know, when we had the meeting on the Saturday afternoon, the joint meeting of the Arts Committee planning on that Saturday, I mean, that was a topic that I brought up to at that particular uh-huh. session, because it has been an ongoing concern. Will we be able to continue to operate at this level? Right. And one of the hopes was that when we did get the planning grant, if we do get the NEA grant, is that we can take all of those things into consideration. And certainly I've encouraged staff to come forth and say, if you need resources, let me know. But that may mean that we may need to contract out, because we may not be able to staff at peak period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So so that's another consideration.
There might be some stuff we just can't do at a particular time. Yeah.
Was this item also about the way people, and Matt explained what it was about, but the way that people reserve the space? I mean, was this just, okay, so are there specific concerns about the way that people are doing that now that we need to be responding to in this discussion?
I don't believe it from the staff's standpoint that there are concerns. There have been concerns raised by the Board of Aldermen in the past about how the process works, from someone coming in wanting to start a new event or someone wanting to reserve the space. And there's been issues over defining what exactly a town-sponsored event is. And to that end, we wanted to kind of throw out all the information of what the current status of everything is. And if there is something the board thinks needs to change, then here's the opportunity of seeing and discussing what exactly the status quo is.
Okay, thank you.
So, I appreciate all the, this, you know, we can talk about the town commons, there's so many facets of it. So we've talked about so far alcohol and town staff and how much depth there is and how many more events we could have relative to what the capacity of staff is. On the other hand, too, is we do have a town commons that just lends itself for a lot of activity and I feel doesn't get used as much as it could. And so I would like for us to consider, and I don't know if that was part of the intention. I think I'd mentioned interest a while ago in figuring out kind of a sliding scale. And we did this somewhat with the Wild Food Market, recognizing the value that once it gets on its feet, it could even be a revenue generator for us. But sometimes there are entities or projects or events that may not have the resources. So to really be thinking in those terms of what are the parameters through which we could waive the fee in recognition of the potential economic development that an event or an organization may bring to the town. Also, the town commons as a resource to support nonprofits as we head in, as the economy is as bad as it is, there may be opportunities. I mean, a lot of this, there is an interesting compilation of, you know, fundraising on town property and that question raised for the town commons. You know, for example, if we had a communal pizza oven, the opportunity there could be for having various nonprofits use any day to have that be a fundraiser and sell pizza or bread, or we could have more facilities, in other words, on the town commons that could support, I mean, maybe not more, but one more, such as a town oven. And there are other places in this country and in Canada where town ovens have been central community builders. A lot of people convene around that, and it can be a really real asset. So I just want to put that on the table for us to consider. Obviously, we won't make the decision tonight, but mainly just exploring the opportunity for both the sliding scale for various organizations on the fee and thinking of opportunities to support local nonprofits if they have fundraising opportunities. I mean, we already do it a lot with races throughout town, but I feel that in as much as this space is not as used as it could be, we have a lot of space to work in. I mean, a lot of room to work in.
Oh, I just want to follow up on that because I do think, again, I want us to be creative about the space and also think about, you know, how much staff is needed for a big event versus what you're suggesting. I think that'd be important in an assessment of how we're going to use the space, because even with a communal oven or something that's ongoing there, I would assume, well, I don't want to assume. I don't know if we need staff there or not. So I would assume we need some sort of staff connection or contact. And we're also talking about staff being overloaded or overwhelmed or overworked. So I don't know how we balance that out. I think we need to consider that in the discussion. I would like the space to be used a lot more, too. And every time we use it more, there's staff that are responsible for those events happening, even if we don't really see that as much.
I guess I wanted to kind of see what the board thought about asking staff to come up with some kind of policy that might allow the use of alcohol on town commons at some type of event.
Yeah.
Have staff to come back to us with a I see some model kind of ordinances,
Chapel,
you know,
Hill's
from Chapel Hill and so
right,
on.
Yeah.
But yeah, come back to us with one. That'd be great. That's a motion.
I also wanted to know if there was anything else in the administrative policy that was from 2005 that anyone thought needed to, or staff recommended any particular tweaking based on the events we now see compared to what was in 2005.
I'm not sure specifically what in 2005.
Well, the administrative policy that was in our packet, that's
okay.
From 2005,
yeah.
And it was just
that section 1420.
Yeah.
Our last
yeah.
big squabble
right.
over this was in 2005,
yeah.
Mr. Mayor.
Yeah. So. You know, and that goes with my question about having, you know, staff report on needs and resources. And I'm just wondering if this policy needs to be tweaked based on that.
But you're not talking about the current administrative policy. You're talking about the...
Yeah. No, I'm looking at the 2005.
You're talking about the one for fundraisers? Section 1420?
For 2019.
Just all of it.
I think Alderman Haven and O'Donnell is referring to attachment C in your packet. That's the current administrative policy that governs the administrative policies and procedures for reserving the town commons. And if I can back up just 1 second to one of Sammy's questions. One of the reasons that this item's coming back up is, you know, the reservations of the use of the town commons, one of the aspects is the fees and charges schedule. And that specifies the fees and charges that the staff is to charge for events. There is, if you look back in the, one of the past legislative items, the board did make a change to allow for a once-a-month free use if it met certain criteria for the event, didn't involve town staff, didn't need restroom, et cetera. So that policy has been amended by the board in the past. And one of the kind of items for conversation is if that's sufficient for the board's desires to make it a more public use, or if there needs to be something different. Because as it is right now, staff doesn't have the authority to make the decision to waive fees or to make things easier. All of those types of decisions have to come back to the board, and that slows down the process. And that's one of the reasons why we're throwing this out for conversation is that the way the board intends to keep the policy? Does it want all the events to come back to the board?
Right, which also represents staff time.
Right.
Yeah. And...
Thanks, Matt, for pointing that out.
So what happened in 2005 or so was this decision was basically a policy change that was calculated to kind of accommodate the really, really free market. I think that was maybe that was 07. I don't know. Anyway, but the point being that policy that Matt was alluding to a moment ago about saying, well, if you're going to use it once a month and you're not going to need access to the bathrooms in town hall and you're not going to need parks and rec and park staff there for the event, that change in policy was made basically to kind of accommodate the really, really free market and or potentially other things that might be similar to the really, really free market. And, you know, I guess my thought is that I guess I don't see a big need for huge changes to that or for any kind of major. I'm not aware of a major change that's needed to that policy. I mean, I think, you know, basically that really says that just about anybody could use the town commons for just about anything as long as they didn't need access to they didn't need town staff to be there and they didn't need access to the bathrooms in town hall, then just about anybody could use it as long as they weren't planning on using it more than once a month.
And they weren't selling stuff.
Right. Yeah. Right. For just sort of a non-commercial type of use, and that seems like a pretty reasonable policy.
But
so.
Matt's also asking if you know if it's free, you know, is it something that needs to come to us? And you know, am I correct?
Well, I guess my point is that like, I guess here's where I'm having a problem with seeing any changes is well. If the complaint is, well, but we want to do this twice a month or we want to do this every week, that, yeah, I kind of feel like if you're going to use that much town commons resource, maybe you need to come talk to us about
right.
it.
Right.
Or if you want to, if you need access to the bathrooms and you don't want to pay for that, that you darn sure better talk to us about that. So, I mean, I don't see it as a problem.
No.
I'm not saying we would never be flexible. If somebody wanted to follow up on Alderman Slade's idea about, you know, community shared oven or things like that. I mean, I think we could potentially be flexible, but that needs to come back. We need to have a conversation about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty comfortable with how that policy. Sits right now. I guess that's kind of my overall reaction. I like your idea, by the way, Sam.
I do too.
And I think, on the whole, that you know, part of what this whole issue, and was kind of a hot topic back, whatever that was, 5 or 6 years ago. But part of what this whole issue gets down to is that our for whatever reasons. Jackie and others who were on the Board of Aldermen many years ago when we adopted the name Town Commons for this space out here had a kind of, there were some philosophical implications behind that, and, you know, I support what those philosophical implications were, and that the concept is really, that it is something different than just a town park,
right.
You know, and that it really ought to be a piece of land that's sort of for the common use of the people of Carrboro, subject to certain rules,
mm-hmm.
so that we're protecting the interests of others and neighbors and so forth. But anyway, let's mm-hmm. anyway.
So
that's where I'm coming from.
I've raised the question as to whether or not this the administrative policy from 2005 needs to be any tweaking. And
I'm not seeing it right now.
So.
I'm not here. I mean, I'm open to hearing about it, but
there's no tragedy on this commons.
So, as it currently stands, as I read this, nice. Is that anyone can reserve for free for every month, and but
one
that still has to come through
to us.
Back to us.
Yeah, and I mean, so that we're clear, the other thing that you need to, the other footnote on that is that it is important to realize that certain activities are going to require insurance. And so if you're serving food and perhaps doing some other things, that there may be some insurance requirements.
And you don't have to reserve it. If you show up and nobody's there,
right,
and you're a non-commercial use, it's the commons.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to advertise.
As long as it's not been reserved, anybody can use it in a non-exclusive way.
As we notice in the summer during our meetings.
When the drummers turn up and start drumming, but that gets back to the kind of philosophical implications of the name that you and others gave to it, which is, you know, as long as you're not sort of overly infringing on others' rights.
So to the question of
it's available.
Other facilities on the town commons, I know it's on our CIP to do improvements, but it may be valuable to have some kind of visioning community-wide to think about before the CIP, and maybe even to fund it through community work or donations. But the idea of visioning with the town commons, working with the farmers market and all those who currently use it and the community at large, to identify some small features that it could take right now to really expand its use significantly. And of course, like, my proposal would be the oven, but within that process,
I
think it would be valuable.
Let's, Sammy, may I suggest, let me ask you if you could possibly bring us some kind of proposed resolution as far as how we might have such a stakeholder public conversation process about it.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be anything elaborate, but
cool.
So that we can kind of put how to put that into action as far as receiving that kind of community input.
Cool.
Yeah, 'cause you mentioned some other places do it too.
Yeah, I guess my point is almost more that it's not a question of whether I'm willing to have a stakeholder or community meeting about the broad topic, but we need to be clear about how we make sure that all the voices.
Yeah, you know,
so that everybody has an opportunity to participate.
And a related item is when we were looking at Shelton Station, the policy of identifying amenities in the vicinity that the developer can do payment in lieu. Like, it would be valuable too to identify those kinds of features in our downtown, throughout town, that folks could identify. So, for example, one is like a communal bicycle repair station, and it's got attached like wires, you know, as one idea. Or the Cobb oven, if it were closer to Shelton Station, perhaps that payment in lieu would serve to pay for such
to
a thing.
Make it happen.
Yeah. So yeah. We needed that kind of list so that when a developer says, okay, we would like to do a payment in lieu, they could even see something.
Connect it all up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All I'm proposing at this point is that we take a look at a resolution that would spell out what that process is for discussing
sure.
that
yeah,
and kind
gladly,
of identifying those desires
gladly
and needs.
Do that. Thanks for the invitation.
Okay. All right.
There was a motion in a second.
There was a motion in a second. I can't even remember what the motion in a second are. Oh, about the alcohol policy specifically. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, I'm pressing unanimously. All right. I believe it is time for us to go into closed session to discuss a possible property acquisition issue. Is there a motion to go into such a session?
So moved.
Been moved.
Second.
By Randy and seconded by Michelle. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. If all those of you who are not a part of the relevant town staff would pardon us.
Yeah.
And we look forward to seeing you another time.
I'm just forgetting my people.